Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When a withering disease attacked wheat in Uganda in 1999, Danish plant pathologist Bent Skovmand led the charge to save the world's wheat harvest. His quest did not make headlines. Skovmand didn't become a household name, but his success in finding disease-resistant strains helped Africa, China, India, Pakistan, America, and more avert disaster and safeguard their amber waves of grain. This hour on Point, our daily bread, its surprising vulnerability, and the Indiana Jones story of one wildly committed scientist who helped keep it on our tables. You can join the conversation. Do you have any idea what it takes to stay one step ahead of threats to the world's wheat supply? Do you take for granted that your food will just be there? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now in the studio is Susan Dworkin, author of the new book, The Viking in the Wheat Field, as scientists struggle to preserve the world's harvest. Susan Dworkin, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. This is quite a story. I have to say, I had no idea. I mean, I sort of did, and then I really didn't. What it takes to keep our crops a step ahead of pathogens, of wheat rust, of climate change, of the whole thing. It is, as you describe it, before we even get to the hero of your story, it's a nonstop battle. It's going on all the time while we just casually slap the mayonnaise on the bread and make a sandwich.
It certainly is. It's a nonstop battle. It goes on all the time. The basic motor that underlies agriculture is that we are going to have on this planet an estimated 9 billion people by 2050.
Up from something like 6 billion now, half again as much, and it feels crowded already.
That's right. And they're going to need a lot more food. Some people estimate a 75% increase in food. That's a lot, especially since most of the arable acres are already under cultivation.
So what that means is a constant effort to have higher yielding strains of any crop, wheat in particular, which is so important in so many countries. 25% of global calories, you write, from wheat.
It's interesting. Wheat is about 25%. Rice is about 25%. Mm-hmm. And everything else from apples to mm-hmm. asparagus,
you name it,
is 50%.
Mm-hmm.
So those two crops, if something happens to the wheat or something happens to the rice, we are in terrible, terrible trouble.
But we don't tend to think that, you know, the staff of life, our daily bread, is rolling along vulnerable. Why does the pressure for higher yields up the vulnerability of the very foundational crop that feeds so much of the world?
This is the perfect question. Dr. Skovmand, who was the world's leading wheat banker.
Danish wildman, Indiana Jones, seed stalker extraordinaire.
Exactly. Who died in 2007,
mm-hmm.
he put it very succinctly. He said, since the beginning of agriculture, there's been a struggle between providing enough food, getting enough yield, and keeping the biodiversity in the world that you need to keep the crop viable.
But who cares about the biodiversity? Let's just get the high-yielding seeds, plant them, and eat.
You can't quite do that. It doesn't quite work that way. And the reason is that every time you plant a plant, some bug or some change in the weather or the soil or the water is going to come along and threaten that plant. And you've got to be prepared to rebreed it all the time, to add new genes, to add new traits, to add new vulnerabilities and take away new vulnerabilities.
So that crop can defend itself.
That's exactly right.
That's going on all the time. You've just been out in the up in Minnesota.
Minnesota,
I think.
Yeah.
What is it's happening out there right now?
Yes, it is. I'll tell you all about that. The thing that protects our wheat is our ability to rebreed it constantly. The thing we need when we need to rebreed it is a collection of genes and traits. Those genes and traits are saved in seed banks. There are about 1,400 of them.
The famous
in this
one,
world.
The Doomsday Vault, up north of Norway, way up on the island there, under permafrost and
400
cement.
400 feet of rock and stone mm-hmm. and terrible ice. And And yet that's not the one that's real. That's a kind of insurance policy. The working seed banks, we have about 25 of them in the United States in something called the National Plant Germplasm System.
Okay.
It's a system all over the country that specializes in potatoes in Wisconsin and rice in the South and apples in New York.
So that when suddenly a certain strain of any of those or of wheat becomes vulnerable, what they dip into that seed bank
exactly.
to pull out the traits
That's
needed to
do.
Defend.
To rebreed it. And we have agriculture schools all over the country. The one I was at in Minnesota has a very big specialty in wheat and wheat diseases, wheat rust particularly.
Well, take us back to a particular story. Uganda, 1998. It sounds far away in time and space, and like, why should we care? But you portray very vividly why billions of people's fates depended on what happened with this outbreak in Uganda. Remind us of the story.
Yeah, this is what happened. In 1998, a scientist at a wheat experimental station in Uganda noticed that there was an outbreak of this awful-looking, horrible disease called stem rust, which looks like smallpox on the wheat. That's what it looks like.
Gross.
And it's horrible.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a fungal disease spread by spores, microscopic spores,
which
blow
on the wind.
On the wind.
Mm-hmm.
Right, they blow on the wind.
And not just a couple of hundred feet.
And not just a couple of hundred spores, billions of them on the trade winds blowing across international borders.
Across oceans, even.
That's right. So what happened was he noticed this stem rust, and there's been stem rust before, but they had for about 50 years, the scientists had bred into various strains of wheat certain genes which really protected the wheat against the stem rust. So it worked for 50 years. Nobody expected it to stop working.
We thought
and
everything
suddenly,
was cool. We were settled.
Voom.
In Uganda.
A new race in Uganda. And what happened was he reported it to the various seed banks and seed distributors around the country and scientists around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And the wind came and it blew it into Kenya. And then it blew it across the Red Sea into Yemen. And then it started up the Arabian Peninsula.
Mm-hmm.
And then it got to Iran, where we don't exactly have wonderful relations with the scientific community at this moment, but you would be surprised.
Nevertheless, what happens in their fields is part of the wind system that affects everybody.
And what happens next is that it's heading for Pakistan and India.
A gigantic breadbasket when it comes to wheat.
20% of the world's wheat.
And just over the Himalayas from China
wheat.
At that
That's
point.
That's right. And once it gets to China, and it gets to Russia, and then it gets to France, and then it gets to Kansas. Now, we can, if such a catastrophe were to happen, we can spray. But those farmers in India and Pakistan, they've got 14 hectares of wheat and no money. They can't spray. They don't think about spraying fungicide.
And spraying is not without its costs either. So what happened? What was the global response to this? Suddenly it's in the trade winds. It's a threat to billions.
The first global response was terror. Terror, because we checked the people at the Agricultural Research Service in Washington, which is a subdivision of the USDA and takes care of all this stuff, they looked at all the breeds of wheat in the United States, and they found that this new stem rust called UG99 would kill 80% of them.
Of American
wheat. That if it came
here
tomorrow.
The amber waves of grain, down.
Down. 80% of American wheat was vulnerable.
Could we spray fast enough to stop that?
Yes and no.
A lot of spray. A lot else out there.
That's right. You know, and how long does it last? The solution, obviously, is to create new wheat with new strains and new traits that will defend against the new pathogen.
So your guy, the hero of your story, Bent Skovman, goes into action.
That's yes and no. Mm-hmm. He was the guy who was the central librarian for all the genes.
Mm-hmm.
So he went into action, and so did scientists from 40 other countries.
I mean, but that's where the action lies.
That's
is
right.
What do you have to fall back on here?
That's
what's
right.
What's the gene bank, the seed bank you can pull from to fight this? How do you do it? Is it like
if
a librarian who says, you've got the stem rust in Uganda, let me just go and see what I've got for that? They pull out a drawer. No, here it is. You know,
that's with Skovmund. That's not such an exaggeration. It's an exaggeration, mm-hmm. but it's not gross exaggeration. Mm-hmm. He knew what was in that bank. If the Australians came to him and said, we have a terrible drought problem, or the Brazilians came to him and said, we have a terrible aluminum problem in our soil, he knew just in his mind from being in this for so long what was in that bank. Actually, the process of finding strains of wheat that will be invulnerable to UG99 is requiring tremendous research from many scientists all over the world, and it's being funded very heavily by the Gates Foundation, Bill and Melinda Gates. Mm.
Ben Scoveman knew so much about it because he had traveled the world collecting talking
it.
With farmers, seeing what worked where, what they had, and he had brought all that seed back. I mean, Time magazine once said he was more important to people's daily lives than most heads of state. The
exactly.
Queen of Denmark knighted him. Well,
they knighted
who's
him.
A Danish knight? But he was.
He was knighted for his service to humanity in 2003. And he was, and people like him who have tried to replace him today are a kind of small brigade of scientists, maybe 5,000 max mm-hmm. in the whole world, who guard these strains of wheat. Some of them are ancient. Some of them are weeds. Some of them are stuff that we see by the side of the road that are related to wheat. But
weeds we may need.
That's right.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about one man's quest to secure the global seed stock, the genetic diversity to feed a hungry planet. Susan Dworkin writes about Bent Scoveman in her new book, The Viking in the Wheat Field. She tells the story of a Danish plant pathologist, Bent Scoveman, a hard-living guy. He smoked too much. He drank too much, you write, Susan.
Stopped too late.
He stopped all those too late, but he may also have saved an awful lot of lives. Now and into the future, give us a sense of his life kind of on the road, at work, going around the planet. What was he looking for?
He was looking for information from other scientists and from farmers, and he was looking for seed. They went everywhere. Bent Scoveman traveled 150, 160 days of the year.
Banking seeds.
Collected everything. And after a while, people knew about him. So they would send him stuff. And this is the way the seed bank worked. You needed a new kind of wheat that would grow at a very high altitude.
Okay.
He had some wheat that he collected from Tibet. Wheat that he'd collected from Ecuador,
mm-hmm.
or from the Himalayas,
mm-hmm.
or from the Andes.
Mm-hmm.
He would send it to you. He would send you the seed. You would breed your new wheat.
Mm-hmm.
When you had it, when it was up and thriving in the field, you would send him back to the seed bank the new strain that you had bred.
So he'd have yet another
exactly.
enhanced
And you would
line.
Send him your field notes, too, so that the scientists coming after you would understand the research and the mixing and the breeding that had gone into creating this new wheat.
Now, he wouldn't ditch the old one when you'd found
no.
a new one, because the old stock is the ancient sort of inheritance
exactly.
we've got.
Everything is an accumulation of genes. And the more you plant and the more you breed, the deeper and wider the genome, the gene bank becomes.
Now, let me understand. It's not just wheat where this goes on. You write about the National Plant Germplasm System in
yes.
the United States. 20 different gene banks, each specializing in a different crop. They do it for animals, too. The USDA has got 13,000-plus species of plants, from roses to cauliflower to maple trees to flax. You say it conserves more than 500,000 samples, or as they call them, accessions?
Accessions,
right. And that's all about the genetic safety of the future of our food. So you've got cotton seeds stored at College Station, Texas, and corn in Urbana, Illinois, and Arctic plants in Palmer, Alaska, and tropical fruits and nuts in Hawaii, rice in Arkansas, potatoes in Wisconsin.
Not only does nobody know about it, they have to fight for funding.
Even though it's the very future of what
yes.
we have to. But this
one
is,
of the reasons mm. that I wrote this book mm-hmm. was because I felt I'm an urban person myself.
Mm-hmm.
I live in New York. I felt that people in urban and suburban areas don't know anything about the way the agriculture system works. And what happens is that if you don't know what they do it to you.
Yes.
And you find that you're in a situation where we're talking about food security.
Mm-hmm.
And a bunch of corporations and a bunch of bureaucrats are making these decisions, these vast decisions, basically in secret because there's no civic conversation. There's no larger, broad civic conversation.
And
there is in the farm belt.
Absolutely fundamental.
That's right. When do you remember the presidential debates between Obama and McCain?
Mm-hmm.
I watched those debates. I said to myself, no one has talked about farming. In all these debates, there's no
Talk about the ag bill and subsidies,
yes,
but when you get right down to what comes out of the earth and what's
going
planted,
on,
the seed
what's
that goes
really
in.
Going on. So one of the motivations for writing about Dr. Skovmand, whom I had long admired and long read about, and writing about this whole problem of saving enough genetic traits so that we are prepared to rebreed every crop if necessary. One of the reasons that I embarked on this project was to increase the numbers of people who are ready to get in and dig in on this conversation.
Because it's what we eat, and we will have to rebreed. With climate change, climates are changing.
Exactly.
You never know what you're going to need
you
next.
Got it.
The book is The Viking in the Wheat Field. I'd like to go to Rita, please, if we could, in Hampton, New Hampshire.
Thank you for taking my call. I was wondering if you have the same problem with rye, for instance.
Rye.
Yeah, rye.
R-Y-E, rye, as it was with wheat.
You know, rye bread is fantastic.
Yes.
I eat probably only rye bread here, very hardly ever wheat bread, because from the rye bread you eat one slice and you are satisfied.
Yes, wheat, it's got density.
Or three.
Yeah, no, it's a great point. What about it?
You know, it's very interesting. This problem is a problem across the board. That's for starters. So there isn't a crop in the world that escapes these dangers. The interesting thing is that Skovmand spent years of his life, as did the late Norman Borlaug also, trying to breed a combination of wheat and rye called triticale, because rye is this very tough, impervious to cold kind of northern plant, and wheat is a more delicate plant which gives you a whiter bread when you breed it. And they tried very hard
to get them together, toughen up that wheat a little bit.
Not an easy job. It's taken 100 years. And in the crop that they came up with is called triticale.
Has it been adopted? Do people like it?
No,
But is it a good survival
food? Pigs like
it. Oh, well, geez.
Chickens like it, which is, this is good,
too.
Yeah,
it's good. Yeah,
it's good,
yeah.
Too. People have not taken to it. They haven't solved the big taste problem. But the thing about triticale is that it grows. It's 30% higher yield than either wheat or rye, and it grows without too much finickiness in most soils, including the developing world. Mm-hmm. So it has been considered a good crop, even for animal feed in the developing world.
There may be a way to get these together. Ann in East Haddam, Connecticut, you're on the air with Susan Dworkin, Ann.
Hi. I read a book about something where they created a hybrid wheat in India, and it was very resistant to all kinds of insects. However, after it grew for a while, it also, bees were resistant to it, and they wouldn't pollinate.
There's a side effect to everything. There's no way to make an improvement without having a little bit of a side effect that may affect birds or may affect bees or may affect taste or yield or some other trait. And that's why we constantly have to rebreed the wheat that we distribute in this world.
Which is why the seed banks are so important.
Exactly.
There's no static condition here. That's
climate
changes, what the pathogens change. It's always evolving.
If you grow a kind of wheat and you find that the bees, actually, bees don't pollinate wheat. Wheat is a self-pollinating
mm-hmm,
crop.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But if it affects the health of bees in the area, mm-hmm. that will affect other crops in the area.
Let's go to Jerry in Brattleboro, Vermont. Jerry, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. The problem is the genetically modified, and I'm sure that this is what she's talking about. Am I correct?
I'm not really talking about genetic modification. I'm really talking about seed banks, but go ahead.
But this is, you're talking...
I'm concerned because mm-hmm. they're saying they're the hybrids genetically modified, and the people that grow all this stuff are being super controlled by Monsanto seed banks, seed organizations. And, you know, there's a lot of people that are out there struggling and growing, and they're not able to even keep part of their seed for the next year's planting. But I'm just saying that is this a genetically formed wheat that you're talking about?
It's a good question, Jerry. I'm sure others are wondering the same. Susan, can you lay out? I mean,
yes.
Everybody knows about GMO,
yes.
you know, foods. People, a lot of concern about that. On the other hand, people, farmers, geneticists have been making hybrids, breeding hybrids since the beginning of human time anyway. What's genetic modification?
A hybrid is different from a genetically modified plant. A genetically modified plant means that you're putting something into the plant that doesn't grow there naturally, like a Monsanto chemical or a BASF chemical. A hybrid, when we say a hybrid wheat, or a mixed wheat, it may be two different kinds of wheat. So you're not putting something into the wheat that doesn't come from the wheat genome. Am I making that clear?
Well, they're natural lines of wheat that are blended
exactly.
for your hybrid, but it's not going into the genome and artificially directly manipulating
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
Then you've
and
got
so
genetic
these,
modification.
The gene bank, for example, the gene bank at the Svalbard Global Seed Vault, which...
This is the island up north of Norway,
yes,
the Doomsday Vault.
There are no genetically modified crops there. All the seeds that people have, various countries, maybe 120 countries, have deposited seeds in that vault as a kind of insurance policy for their food crops. There are no genetically modified crops in that vault. And it's very important to make that distinction because there's been so much talk about GM and so much mm-hmm. Information given, some of it true, some of it false, on all sides, that people get confused. They think Monsanto's got its finger in every crop and every seed. The fact is that most crops and most seeds in the world are just made by Mother Nature. And the question is, how long is that going to go on? Because, as Dr. Skovmund often said, if we're not careful, four companies are going to control the seed supply of the entire world. The range of genetic modification has grown and grown and grown in corn, in cotton, in soybeans. And there's a whole political aspect to that, which is part of another question. But I just want to make it clear mm-hmm. for this caller the difference between what was in Dr. Skovmund's seed bank mm-hmm. and what is a Monsanto product.
Genetically modified.
Exactly.
We'll talk more about the privatization issue. I want to welcome another voice into this conversation right now, if I may. Susan Dworkin's new book is The Viking in the Wheat Field. We've got another Viking standing by here. From Ithaca, New York, we're joined by Per Pinstrup Anderson. He's professor of food, nutrition, and public policy at Cornell University, winner of the extremely august World Food Prize in 2001. We're honored to have him with us today. Per Pinstrup Anderson, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Hello.
Hello. Your focus has been on world hunger. That's directly related to the work we're talking about here with seed banks, the food available today and the food available in the future. Give us a sense, if you'd be good enough, right now of world hunger. How does it stand? Where does it stand, Professor?
It is presumably the most important problem that the human society is facing right now. Imagine you're in a room with 69 other people. There are 70 of you in there. 10 of you will be unable to obtain the food you need if that 70 people, in fact, represent the world population. So 1 in 7 people do not get enough to eat today. You already mentioned earlier that we're going to be at least 9 billion people by 2050, up from about 6.8 billion today. And all those additional people, of course, would like to eat as well. So what we're talking about here is really the building blocks for the future food supply. And if we fail to maintain those building blocks, whether we put them in gene banks or we keep them on the fields, we are failing future generations, and we're going to see a lot more hunger and starvation and malnutrition in the future. This is extremely important what this Viking we've been talking about
right.
has been doing.
Can you tell us how important is this genetic diversity of the seed banks to sustaining or bolstering food supplies on the planet?
Well, let me compare it to putting a little money in the bank for future problems. Let's suppose you lose your job. Wouldn't it be nice to have a little money in the bank? Suppose that a new plant disease, and we've been talking about wheat rust, but there are many, many other adverse mm-hmm. Conditions in agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
Suppose the insects would like to get access to the food before the humans do. Wouldn't it be nice if we had in the gene banks the kind of plant material that would help plant breeders develop a variety that would be resistant to those insects or resistant to the plant diseases? Or what about the droughts that are currently going on in Kenya?
Mm-hmm.
People are dying because the droughts are killing the crops. There is simply nothing to eat in many of these rural households that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
What if we could develop drought-tolerant crop varieties? And I don't really care whether we use GMOs or we use some other approach, as long as we test the results before they are released for production by farmers. These are problems that we can talk about in the abstract, and we can say 1 billion people don't get enough to eat, now let's go and have lunch.
Mm.
Or we can say, look, here's a child that's going to die tomorrow unless it gets food. And that's what we should be talking about. And I'm not trying to over-dramatize, but 5 million preschool kids died last year because they couldn't get enough food to meet their nutritional requirements.
How big is the challenge we're facing as we move over the next just now 4 decades from a population of 6 billion to a population, we're told, of 9 billion coming? How big is the challenge?
Well, as Susan pointed out, we are going to need to increase food supply in the world by somewhere between 60% and 80% between now and 2050. That can be done by means of a combination of science and good government policy, particularly good government policy in developing countries. So it's not as though we're looking towards an impossible situation where by 2050 we are going to be short of food no matter what we do. The problem is complacency. Right now the world is investing very little in productivity increases in agriculture. We need to help farmers to produce more per unit of land, per unit of water, and per unit of sunshine. And we need to put a lot more, and by we, again, I'm talking about the world community. The world community needs to invest a lot more in agricultural research of the kind that's needed to generate the food supply that we're going to need in the future, and to help that billion people get enough to eat. That we have a current problem and we have a future problem. We can solve both of these problems, but not if we continue to sit on our hands.
You want to know about the urgency of staying on top of what's growing in the fields? There it is, and powerfully put by the 2001 winner of the World Food Prize, Per Pinstrup Andersen at Cornell University. Professor Pinstrup Andersen, thank you very much for joining us for a few minutes here.
A pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about one man's quest to secure the global seed stock, the genetic diversity required to feed a hungry planet. Susan Dworkin has written about Bent Skovmand in her new book. It's The Viking in the Wheat Field, a scientist struggled to preserve the world's harvest. She joins me today in the studio. You can read an excerpt of the book at our website, onpointradio.org. Let's get a call from Ramona, California. Paul, you're on the air with Susan Dworkin.
Yes, hi. Like we saw with the recent influenza outbreak of the H1N1 virus, you know, the big concern there was there wasn't enough vaccination to feed or take care of the population.
Mm-hmm.
If something like that happened to the wheat, how could they possibly respond quick enough to a global crisis?
With the volume of seed required to replace, if they had to replace, how about it, Susan? How does that work? How fast can you ramp up?
It's
a seed bank is not a silo of each seed.
Very good question. The UN says that they have stocks of wheat that are lower than ever before in UN history. That's about a one-month supply.
If
there was
food.
No wheat, that's food.
Food to eat. But so, Paul's asking about seed stock, I guess.
Seed stock is always available. It's always available.
Enough
because
to replant vast fields?
The wheat produces the seed itself, right?
I mean, yeah,
you gather the seed from the wheat if you can plant it.
Yeah, but if something's gone wrong, if it's no longer working, if it's suddenly overwhelmed by rust or a blight or some sharp climate change.
The seed banks have the seed stock.
But they've
have
only
the
got
seed stock.
A tray or something. They don't have billions
right.
of bushels to plant.
Yes, but once you plant one plant, think of this. You plant a plant, one little plant, one seed produces mm-hmm. a plant which produces a lot of seeds.
Still, doesn't it take several years
yes.
to get enough of a
there
new hybrid on the market to...
There you go. That's the problem. The problem is time. The problem is always time. That's why these seed banks, which are endemically underfunded
mm-hmm.
all over the world.
Who funds them? National governments or
national
the UN?
Governments. Or? The UN doesn't really do a lot of funding.
The Gates Foundation?
The Gates Foundation, Rockefeller, Ford,
mm-hmm.
the Global Crop Security Trust, which runs the Svalbard Vault, the Doomsday Vault,
mm-hmm.
is trying to raise $450 million. That's not a lot of money when you're talking about saving the world.
Maybe we don't have to worry about it because private industry will take care of it.
Private industry takes care of its bottom line. Private industry takes care of crops that are profitable to private industry. Therefore, a crop like sorghum or a crop like cassava, which are the bread, the kind of the
staples,
the staples mm-hmm. of the developing world, are of very little interest to private industry. Corn,
mm-hmm.
especially if you can somehow make it into ethanol, which
mm-hmm.
may not
or Twinkies.
Be or Twinkies. Corn is of great interest. Soybeans is of great interest. And the thing you have to understand about investment of private industry in crops is that those investments pay off for farmers. That's why, I mean, look at Brazil. Brazil has grown into a great power
mm-hmm.
with the considerable help of Roundup Ready soybeans. That can never be denied.
Mm-hmm.
Private industry
Roundup
is
Ready
beginning...
meaning they can be sprayed for weeds and it doesn't hurt the beans,
exactly.
so you can do a big
it's
volume wheat
like
free.
Like the way it's a product that
yeah.
you use,
mm-hmm.
an herbicide.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that's important to remember is that farmers who are different from gardeners,
mm-hmm.
farmers will plant for their bottom line. Farmers are not going to plant a crop which brings them no money. They're
so
not
going to plant for the high yield.
They're going to profess the
and they're
high
all
yield,
do
the
it.
High price.
But that gets us the, what do you call it, monoculture that's vulnerable to a single hit if there's a
exactly.
rust that will hit it.
So the break against monoculture,
mm-hmm.
the break against the market is the gene banks. Monoculture is good for business. Diversity is good for humanity.
But presumably those private companies, it's almost like Wall Street. If the worst happens, they're going to come to the seed banks for a bailout. They're going to say, give us some seed that will
they've
work.
Also got replacements of their own.
Well, that's what I was asking, though.
Yes,
can we count on those replacements?
It depends on whether you can count on them for food.
What about wheat, for wheat?
There, thus far, wheat is not in the hands of, wheat seed is not in the hands of the big major corporations.
Why
they
not?
There were a lot of difficulties with wheat. Number one, it's a self-pollinating crop and it's hard to make it a hybrid crop like corn.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, there was such an outcry against genetic modification in the 90s
mm-hmm.
and the turn of the century,
mm-hmm.
that a lot of major American corporations, Anheuser-Busch, which was then an American corporation.
Takes a lot of wheat to make beer.
And
mm-hmm.
the potato people and McDonald's, people who were in the business of purveying crops, foodstuffs that were made from these crops, they wouldn't be able, they said, we can't sell this stuff if it's got GM seed,
mm-hmm.
if it's made from GM seed.
Mm-hmm.
And that was particularly true in Europe. If you had a European market or a Japanese market,
mm-hmm.
you couldn't sell GM wheat. So Monsanto, for example, got out of the wheat business in 2004,
hmm.
turned its attention elsewhere. Just this last year, after 5 years, they bought a very important company called Westbred, which was the biggest private, one of the biggest private wheat breeders in the country.
So they're
and they're heading
wheat.
Back into wheat.
Let's get a call from Diane in Lansing, Michigan. Diane, you're on the air.
Aloha, Tom and Susan.
Aloha.
Hi.
It's warm here in Michigan.
Oh, good. We'll put on our Hawaiian shirts.
Okay. And wheat is very close to my stomach. About every 6 weeks, I buy a 50-pound bag of stone ground wheat flour from ConAgra and
wow.
make my own bread through the next 6 weeks.
Beautiful you.
Well, it's an economic necessity. But,
okay.
I am worried about the GM, and you sound like you've touched on that because...
The genetic modification. In Michigan, we have to distinguish between cars, I guess. And
right. A genetically modified
mm-hmm,
wheat,
mm-hmm.
As Susan just mentioned, was rejected back in the 90s, and I'm worried that, and she's just touching on that,
mm-hmm.
are they going to, do we still have the political clout, the farmers or whoever, to or marketplace clout to
mm-hmm.
prevent it from coming back?
That's a good question. When Monsanto buys back in, does it mean that they will genetically modify, or might they just do the kind of thing that your guy, Bent Skovman, did?
I think Monsanto intends, you'd have to ask Monsanto
mm-hmm.
what they intend to do,
mm-hmm.
but in general, they spend hundreds of millions of dollars to modify crops so that they will be either resistant to an herbicide, or have some other trait that will make them yield more and bring a better price to farmers.
But that'll have a genetically modified label on it if they go
their
way.
No, there are genetically modified labels. It's a big problem in our country.
Well,
we don't exactly have labels.
But it wouldn't be the sort of old-fashioned...
Correct. I don't think that's what's in their mind to keep
mm-hmm.
traditional breeding. But I'll tell you something else. And in all honesty, and this is important because... Dr. Pinstrup Anderson mentioned it.
Mm-hmm.
In the course of writing this book, I interviewed more than 100 scientists, many of them very prominent.
Mm-hmm.
Not one of them believes that we can feed the world without genetically modifying crops. Not one of them.
And that's where, you mean, as we head to that 9 billion?
Yes. And wow. There's a big difference between genetic modification, which involves privately held genes or
mm-hmm.
privately held products,
mm-hmm.
and genetic modification, for example, like triticale or golden rice, which is where you're combining genes from different kinds of plants, but nobody, the public is still in the owner's seat. The public, it's public research.
Does it matter to the person eating it and their health who owns it?
It depends on the price.
Well, isn't the health issue different from the ownership issue?
Like, it is different, except that ownership will sometimes and very often prevent something from being affordable if it's privately held.
Mm-hmm.
That was my point about cassava and
mm-hmm,
sorghum.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Sanford in Malone, New York. Sanford, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My point is just after what they said about not being able to feed the world. I believe with all the resources that we have now, if the farmers were turned loose, and I'm talking about both in the United States and other places in the world,
okay.
we could feed the people with the current technology. It's going to take the genetically modified technology down the road, but there's a vast potential for making crops that is not being used.
Sanford, are you in the business, first of all? Are you farming? And what do you mean turned loose?
I'm a dairy farmer, yeah.
And what would it mean to be turned loose? What would it mean to be turned loose, Sanford?
Well, if we were paid for our crops, we would produce them. the thing that's holding us back is the economics. So if the price goes up, we'll produce more. Across the United States, that's true, and it would be true across the world, actually. Now, there is government problems in a lot of countries, not in our country, but in a lot of countries. Like, I'll say the Ukraine, for instance. There's vast potential there for producing crops.
So turn them loose. What do you say, Susan? There's no problem. Just let, I don't know, let them plant. Plant fence row to fence row or ditch to ditch.
I tell you the truth. I think that when you say there are problems in other countries but not in ours, that that's maybe an oversimplification. There are problems in every country with the regulation of farm markets. This is a very complicated business. I'll try and give you an example. Let's talk about Haiti. Let's talk about Haiti because it's just been in the news.
Mm-hmm.
Haiti is a country which had evolved almost entirely to tourism, and its economy—it's lost its farm economy. They were living entirely, really entirely, on imported food.
Isn't that partly because of free trade agreements?
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. So you have a little country here like Haiti, and they're living on imported food. Mm-hmm. Should be a big deal, right? You know, the port is open, the airport is open.
And then it's not.
And then suddenly it's not.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody is starving. That's the problem. The problem is that in every single country needs to have an indigenous agriculture, which can feed its people, can provide basic nutrition to its people. That requires a government which is on the side of the people, which isn't the enemy of the people. And what happens in much of the world over time, and this is certainly was true of Ukraine, there was a time when the government that was in charge was not on the side of the people.
Of course, you need trade arrangements that don't undermine indigenous agriculture.
Absolutely,
as well. Sanford, we're glad for your optimism, Sanford. I don't know how all this is going to turn out, but we're glad for the optimism you've got with your dairy farming going on right there. Let's go to Garrison in Boston. Garrison, you're on the air.
This is great to talk to you, Susan. I appreciate the opportunity. I wanted to tell you that for someone who had lived through these 30 years at CIMMYT, I think you got it exactly right in your
CIMMYT
book.
Is the gene or seed bank in Mexico where Bent Skovman worked so much.
The gene bank is at the International Center for Corn and Wheat, and it is in Mexico.
Uh-huh.
And I knew Bent Skovman very well.
Great.
And I think she has portrayed in her book with extreme accuracy exactly the conditions and the case. So that said, it's a compliment. Mm. But I also think that in some ways we have other heroes besides Bent, Tsukutoshi Taba with corn, and T.T. Chang with rice, and Mario Gutierrez with corn, and Henry Shands and Steve Eberhardt at the U.S. National Gene Bank, which was denied funding for expansion in the early 90s repeatedly because gene banks are undervalued.
But Susan's nodding a big bravo along with you here, Garrison, to every name you mentioned. She's nodding yes and yes.
Now, I want to simply say that gene banks are an insurance policy against genetic erosion, and that is the narrowing of the genetic base. And it isn't until we have a UG99 that we have genetic vulnerability, which is the disaster. But I also want to say one other thing.
Mm-hmm.
We only have about 350 plant breeders in the public sector in the United States. And that means that there's one person responsible for breeding for 1 million people. And there are very few keystone industries that have one person with his hand on the switch.
There's the warning. That is the reality. Garrison, we're very glad for your call, and someone who knew Bent Skovman firsthand and all the others that you name. Thank you. I want to get one more call if I may. The clock is advancing on us here. But Garrison, thank you. Marjorie in San Francisco. Marjorie, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Hello, yeah. Tom and Susan.
Hi.
I heard about this book from a friend, and once I started it, I couldn't put it down. Could Susan tell us something about the state of awareness of House and Senate members so far of the importance of funding seed banks around the world and what obstacles they might face in trying to pass appropriate levels of funding?
Who would think that a seed bank story would be a compelling thriller? But I agree, Marjorie, it is. What about that awareness,
Susan? It's a wonderful question. The awareness is very, very reduced relative to other things. For example, the people on the House and Senate committees are very aware of the school lunch program. It's a subsidy for kids. It's a subsidy mm-hmm. for farmers.
Right.
It's a subsidy for food companies. And it costs a lot of money. The seed banks don't cost a lot of money.
And yet everything may depend upon
Everything depends on them. If with for, like I was saying, for $400, $500 million, you could keep every crop seed alive and well.
The doomsday vault doesn't do it. We somehow think it's up there in the Norway. We're fine.
No, we're not fine. We're not fine. You have to have proactive seed banks where they're constantly multiplying, where they're constantly breeding traits into new background material so that breeders can then have immediate access to it. Our government has been, as the professor said before, our government has been very negligent about this because we only respond in a crisis.
Are we going to be starving in 2050 when there are 9 billion on the planet?
Not if we're smart. We have a lot of smart people. If the conversation expands to include more and more Americans, more and more people understand this, then we will have a civic conversation that produces good results for everybody.
Well, we're doing our part in that here today. You've certainly done a major piece of work in exactly that effort. The new book is The Viking in the Wheat Field, A Scientist's Struggle to Preserve the World's Harvest. Susan Dworkin, thank you so much for being with
us
today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Listeners, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.